Your Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and the Cromwell Savings Division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. Hometown friends, serving your best banking interests in every way. Now, here is your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is radio historian, collector, Ed Corcoran.
Tonight we have a very special guest. We have Miss Jean Burnett, who was one of the child actors in radio, actresses, I should say, and actually spent her whole career doing all juvenile parts, Dick, so we've had no one quite like this before.
No, this is going to be a special field for us tonight, Jean. I might point out that you're the public relations director of the Wadsworth Athenaeum, which keeps you very busy these days.
Yes, indeed.
But I want to go back to those very, very early years in radio. You were born on Long Island, I guess.
No, at least, I was born right in New York City on 10th Avenue.
But you had your start on
yes,
Long Island.
That's right, at WGBB in Freeport, Long Island, which was a one-room studio.
Now, would it be impolite of me to ask how old you were at the time?
I think I was about 4 or 5, which, if anybody can figure it out, will date me instantly.
Well, Jean, how did you get started? Certainly you didn't go there on your own.
No, I apparently had a fairly good singing voice when I was a little girl, so my mother decided to give me singing lessons. And Ethel Hart, who was my teacher, was connected with Madge Tucker, who was the director of children's programming at National Broadcasting Company. And that's how I got into that particular act. It was before Radio City was built at what is known to a great many people, 711 Fifth Avenue, which was where the studios were in those days.
Very, very famous address, as a matter of fact, for anyone who's an historian of radio.
Yeah, I think it's still being used in some capacity today, Dick. As I recall, it's the same address, but not at the Rockefeller Center, but right immediately in that area.
Were you a singer when you started out?
At first, yes, and then later when my sister came along, my mother used to write little patter songs built around songs of the day, little numbers, I guess you'd call them, and she and I did them together. That we did on Coast to Coast on a bus, which was the Sunday morning National Broadcasting Children's Hour, which was announced by Milton Cross, who was really one of the most beloved men in radio. He was just a wonderful man. He lost his own daughter at an early age. I think she was only about 10 when she died. And he really, really loved the children.
And obviously that was a very famous show on the air for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, were you singing on the program?
Not all the time. There was a mixture on the program of acts of various kinds. That was the days, as you probably remember, tap dancing on the radio and all kinds of things. But there were also little skits and fairy tales and that sort of thing, so we also took parts. And Madge Tucker, who directed that show, also had an afternoon program for children called The Lady Next Door. As you may know, Columbia Broadcasting, which had the Horn and Hardart Hour on Sunday mornings, also had Let's Pretend. So these shows were great rivals of each other. The odd part was most of the audiences didn't know that a lot of the same children were on both of those programs.
Did the network executives know?
Oh, yes. Oh.
Now, just thinking about a 4 or 5 year old child, was there any problem with regard to your height as far as getting to a microphone?
We had boxes. In
really?
Fact, on those children's programs, we had all kinds of sizes of boxes for various ages of children. I had learned to read at home. My mother taught me when I was about 3, so I never had any problem. And in fact, in later years, when I had to memorize a lot of dates and poetry and so forth in school, the early days came in very handy. Of course, on radio, you didn't have to memorize, but I did do stage work where you did. And I had a memory like a steel trap when I was a kid. I wish I had it now.
Yes. Did any of the children memorize their lines because they couldn't read?
Yes, well, my sister, when she first started out, was tiny. She was only about 2 and a half, and so she memorized her part.
2 and a half?
Yes.
No Charlie incredible. Laws in those days?
No. No actors' equity either.
Were there any problems ever with a child,
just deciding that he or she was not going to go on?
Oh, yes, that would happen from time to time. But, you know, radio was funny. It was very informal. And, of course, split-second timing at the same time, so that sometimes if a child did that, we were very ready to step in at a moment's notice. Occasionally, for instance, on some of the soap operas, one of the actors or actresses would wander out for a cigarette and forget to come back on time, and somebody else would just take over.
Including one of the child actors
or
actresses.
Well, occasionally if they could, yeah.
Well, what were the studios like at 711 Fifth Avenue?
Well, they were very plain, and of course they didn't have the kind of soundproofing that we do, so almost all of them were heavily, heavily draped with curtains. That was the way they soundproofed them. And they just had very simple little metal chairs, and that was about it. And those big microphones, the first ones were round and had spikes coming out of them. The next ones were the big black boxes.
Right.
And they picked up everything, so everyone had to be very, very quiet. The way we handled our scripts, especially on the soap operas, everybody stood. We didn't sit down to do radio in those days at all. Was that you unstapled them, and as you got to the end of a page, you just quietly let it slip to the carpeted floor so that it wouldn't make any noise. That was always a big problem, handling the scripts.
What about the sound effects men? Do you recall them in action?
We had more fun watching them because, of course, they had no recordings to work from at all. They either used their voices, and they were incredibly versatile as to what they could do with their voices, you know, crowd sounds, animals, all kinds of people in the background noises. And they would use cellophane crinkled up in their fingers to make the sound of fire. For a gunshot, they would take one of these little metal chairs that were always in the studios and have a strong piece of wood and simply come down on it very hard with a very loud crack, and it made an excellent gunshot. They had big sheets of steel that they rattled to make the sound of thunder. They had big boxes filled with water with paddles inside them, and they would turn it around, and they could get all kinds of water sounds out of that, gentle or storms or whatever. They had an enormous collection of objects. And the sound effects man almost looked like a one-man band.
Mm-hmm,
with all the horse's hooves. They used the bottom, the rubber part of a plumber's helper, and clip-clopped it against their chests to make the sounds of water. They were very busy.
Were you busy? How busy were you as a child actress?
Well, my mother was not, fortunately, I guess, for the rest of our lives, that pushy a stage mother. And she was interested in seeing that we got a good education. So she didn't have us in the studios all the time. I would say, though, that I spent several afternoons a week rehearsing for various programs. And that, as a matter of fact, was why I retired at the ripe old age of 13, because I did want to go on to college. And you can't really do both very successfully.
Mm. Well, that obviously was a decision that you would have to make and make at an early age. But did you have to go to a special school? In other words, if a rehearsal were to be called and it were in the morning or early afternoon, did you have to leave school to attend the rehearsal?
Well, yes. And when I was in eighth grade, I went to professional children's school in New York, because by that time we'd moved to Jackson Heights, which is just outside of New York City. And it really astounds me to think that when I was that age, I was very young when I was in eighth grade. I was only 11. But I used to ride the New York subways by myself all the time. It never occurred to anybody there was anything reason not to. You can imagine that you wouldn't do that today.
No.
But professional children's school was up at Broadway and 60th Street in Columbus Circle. Of course, that's all changed now. And it was geared specifically for children in theater, radio, whatever kind of show business they were in. The hours were 10 to 2. And it was a very, very highly accredited school, but there were no extra courses. You had 4 years of English, 4 years of history, 4 years of math or science, and 4 years of French in high school. And if you were on the show, on the road with a show, as many of the children were, they had a way of doing it in a correspondence course so that you could do all of your work away from school and still get your credits. Nancy Walker was at PCS when I was there, as was Sidney Lumet, who, of course, is now a great film director. And it's funny to look back on Sidney. He was an East Side kid from a very, very poor family, and probably one of the most eager kids I ever met in my life. I can see him now with his hair. It was much too long for those days, always falling in his face, in a beat-up old suit with knickers. He had no particular talent. He didn't sing, he didn't dance, but he was in love with theater. And, of course, he ended up being a movie director of the first rank.
Yeah, I guess he proved his point.
Yeah.
He married some wealthy...
Gloria Vanderbilt.
Gloria Vanderbilt, yes.
They're divorced now.
Now, so far, we've had you on children's programs, on Coast to Coast, on a Bus, and some of the other programs that we used to listen to, like Let's Pretend and so on. But You were also doing adult fare, weren't you?
Yes. Any adult show, like, for instance, the Rudy Valley show or Jack Benny show or the Telephone Hour, whatever happened to be along that needed a child for whatever reason, they would tap into the children that were on the children's program. So some of those nighttime shows, they began to do coast shows for them, but they had no tape. So whenever you did that, you did one show at, say, 7:30, and then you waited around until 10:30 to do the second show for the West Coast and tried to make it exactly the same.
How did you manage to stay awake at the age of 6, 7, or 8?
You took a nap in between. Mm-hmm. They had very comfortable dressing rooms at Radio City when we moved over there in the early 30s, and it was perfectly possible to bed down for a couple of hours in between shows.
You certainly did a lot of shows, and I'd like to hear an example of one of the shows that... You did at one time or another.
Well, we have a soap opera, Dick, a very famous one, The Romance of Helen Trent.
Oh,
and
yes.
I'm afraid that Jean isn't in the episode, but at least we'll get some idea of the flavor of the show, and maybe she could identify who some of the people are who are in it. So it's, I think, around 1948 or so that this was done.
Seeking to reestablish herself in the confidence of the Hollywood Motion Picture Studios, Helen is designing the costumes for a forthcoming Broadway show. And she is sharing her penthouse with Julie Downing, who is to play the Angelou lead in the show. Recently, Michael Fallon, the eminent portrait painter with whom Julie is in love, returned from Ireland. But Michael has brought about a dangerous situation now, for from the first moment he met Helen, he has been secretly more interested in her than in Julie, although Julie, blissfully unaware of this as yet, is happy in what she believes to be the security of Michael's affections. It is mid-afternoon today as we look in on Helen's living room where we find her talking with songwriter Ken McKenzie. Listen.
You know, Ken, today I almost called for a celebration.
Yeah, how's that, Helen?
This morning I finished my very last costume design. No more drawings.
Well, so, you know, Steve's tickled to death with your costumes, Helen. Yesterday down at his office, he launched into a long epic of praise about you. Used all the adjectives. You should have heard it.
I'm glad he's pleased. I feel like I've done a good job, Ken. I certainly hope I have.
Mm-hmm. So you're going over to Philadelphia for the opening of the show?
Oh, you bet I am. I'll be right there. And then on opening night here in New York, I'll entertain some people at the theater. Meg and David Willoughby and Alice Carroll and Dr. Norris.
Mm-hmm.
Has to do with opening up Brown, you know.
Oh, yes, by all means.
Ken, I've got a sure hunch about that tune called Julie you've written for the show.
Yeah? What's your sure hunch?
Oh, the way everybody down at the theater sings it and hums it all the time, the way they all love it. Ken, that song's going to sweep this country. Well, like Music Goes Round and Round did, or some of the other songs have just been terrifically popular hits.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be my most famous acquaintance before long, Mr. McKenzie. You know that?
Yeah, I don't know, Helen.
Well, you are.
You know, I kind of regret calling that song Julie. I wish I'd have made it Susie or most anything else.
Now, why?
Oh, I got ribbed about it pretty much. Well, not that I mind, of course, but by the way, I met Dee Fallon yesterday.
Did you?
Finally. He and Julie were walking up 44th Street, and I ran into them.
How did you like Michael, Ken?
Well, Julie's picked him. I guess he's okay. Hey, look, what goes on, Helen?
What do you mean?
I mean about Julie. She's going around in a perpetual glow. For a while after Michael got here, I knew darn well something was wrong, but here lately, Julie's beamingly, blissfully happy. Why the sudden change?
Well, I don't know, Ken. I guess she's just awfully happy, but... general reason.
Mm-hmm.
She and Michael seemed to...
Oh, hi.
Say hi, yourself.
Hello, what are you all doing? Michael's downstairs in the car, and we're going on a picnic. I just ran out to get some things, and I'm in sort of a hurry. Excuse me if I sort of dashed in and out.
He wants you to phone in, Julie.
Oh, thanks, Helen. I'll call him later. Well, hello, Miss Anthony.
Hello, Julie.
Just sitting here sewing in your room for a while. You know, I think this is the coolest fun in the place this afternoon.
Well, help yourself, Miss Anthony. I've just come in to get a scarf to tie on my hair and get Michael's camera. Oh, well, I won't be here for dinner tonight, Miss Anthony.
Oh, won't you?
Mm-mm. Michael and I have had the bright idea of a picnic. You know the place about an hour's drive up the Hudson where we can have a little trout season all to ourselves with waterfalls and big rocks to sit on. And he can sketch and I can read and then we'll have supper. Doesn't it sound marvelous?
Well, that's fine. Don't you want to send her to fix you up some sandwiches?
Oh, no, thanks, Shelley. Michael had a place downtown fix up some stuff.
The Romance of Helen Trent. Who was the male actor? Did you recognize his voice by any chance, Jean?
Well, you know, I can't... It's very hard for me to remember the names of a lot of those people. because I was pretty young at the time. Ed probably knows.
I think it was Olin Soule.
Oh, he was in a great many radio shows,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. We'll get back to our guest, Gene Burnett, right after this message from our sponsor.
Now that Santa Claus has arrived and those reindeer are resting for another year, those seasonal Christmas bills that so many of us have will soon be arriving too. Let Cromwell Savings Bank or Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank help you with your financial needs. Whatever the worthwhile reason, the folks at Cromwell Savings Bank or Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank invite you to stop in and chat with one of their loan officers. Perhaps the solution to your particular problem is a personal loan, arranged to suit your needs. You'll find a friendly loan officer at any of their six offices. Cromwell Savings Bank has two, one at the corner of Main and West Streets in Cromwell, or at the new Cromwell Plaza office next to Kmart. Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has four offices to serve you, two in Middletown and branches in Montville and Colchester. Stop in soon. Member FDIC. Now back to Dick Bertel.
Our guest on the Golden Age of Radio tonight is Gene Burnett. Gene is Public Relations Director of the Wandsworth Athenaeum, but a child actress way back in the 30s.
That's right.
And the 40s.
We're reminiscing about those years tonight because we've never talked to a child actress before, and we're getting an entirely different perspective of what the business was like. You did some of the top shows, too. I'm just looking at the list of them here, Gene. Jack Benny and The March of Time. What part would you play, for example, on a March of Time?
Well, of course, The March of Time, as you know, was geared to the news of the day. Mm-hmm. And so if there was any kind of child involved, you would play it. There is one funny story about The March of Time, which, by the way, was a very tightly produced show. I mean, things were done in much as they became later in almost all radio shows, a much tighter kind of production than we were used to. The March of Time, for one of their sequences, was looking for someone to play the voice of Mae West. And they sent out their usual audition call, and about 30 women showed up, and also 10-year-old Florence Hallop, who was the sister of Billy Hallop, who was one of the dead-end kids in the later Sidney Kingsley play in the movies. Well, Florence was a real stage kid, and she won the part over all those 30 adults.
Really?
It was funny to see her standing there in her little short dress and her long blonde curls with this sexy voice coming out of her.
Well, of course, in those days and today, you never say no to anything. I mean, you always say, yes, you can do it.
Right.
Can you do
it? Well, she just walked in. They hadn't called for 10-year-olds.
Well, we found out in interviewing the older actors that they were just a clique, and apparently the same is true with child actors and actresses. There were just so many that could do the work, and they had all of the calls. Is that
well, that's
your
right.
experience?
In fact, of course, in those days, there wasn't any actors' equity, and the pay for most of these things was pretty low. But if you had a regular part, which very, very few children did, but adults did, a regular part on a soap opera, easiest job in the world for really quite a nice sum of money. Rehearsing for those shows, we'd come in, I think you maybe spend an hour and a half all together, half hour rehearsing for the next day's show, a half hour rehearsing for today's show, 15 minutes on the air, and you went home and collected $250 a week. It was really marvelous.
And $250 a week in those days was really big money, no
yeah.
question about it. But as you pointed out, children didn't have parts on a regular basis.
Very seldom, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what was it like working with somebody of Jack Benny's caliber? And was that done in New York, or did you go out to Hollywood?
Well, no, he started those shows in New York. And there were several studios on the 8th floor of the National Broadcasting Company, which were entirely used only for those big shows. 8A and 8B, I think, it's hard to remember now what they were, but the big studio 8H, which was where the Rudy Valley show and the big production shows were put on, was simply enormous. And it was more like producing a stage event than it was anything else. You know, in those days, a lot of people went to see radio shows, much now as they go to see television shows. And it was an event to get tickets to go to see people as well known as Rudy Valley do
oh,
a show.
Yes.
Yeah. And they did it pretty much that way, as if they were doing it for a live audience. And it always gives actors a much, much more responsive feeling when they have people sitting in the audience responding, although they had to be very quiet.
Yeah, I wrote for tickets for the Kay Kaiser show back in the 30s. I haven't got them yet, so maybe someday they'll come in.
Well, be sure to let us know. We'll send you down there, okay?
Yeah. For the most part, those people that were quite well-known were very nice to work with. I don't know whether it was because we were children or what, but they were always very pleasant.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, did they work with you? Did they help you with your lines, that sort of thing?
No, not that sort of thing. They figured we should know what we were doing by then.
Yeah. You weren't in awe of these people either. In fact, you didn't know who they were half the time, did you?
That's right. No, well, they didn't look the same in real life. You know, as I said, he was saying to you earlier, a great many male actors, for instance, are much smaller in real life. The ideal kind of body conformation for a movie actor is to have a large head and a fairly small body. And that's what was so startling. They'd end up being 5'6" or 5'7" when you were expecting somebody much bigger than that.
Well, you know, I thought you were kidding earlier. I thought that you meant an ego when you said
a large head and a small body.
And this is what you found for the most part.
Yeah, it was really surprising.
Thinking back, of course, Alan Ladd was a very short
tiny
man.
Tiny little man, yeah. Yes. They always had to put him on boxes or dig holes for the ladies he was playing opposite.
I read that William Powell was only 5'3". I just can't believe it, but I read that someplace.
Well, that is pushing it just a bit. What about the A&P Gypsies? Did you ever work with that group?
Well, again, that was another one of Milton Cross's programs, and I remember the great gaffe that he made one night. You know, the announcing was done with great flourish, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the A&G Pipsies." Of course, whenever that happened, the whole studio would break up, but you had to be very quiet about your laughing. You couldn't just turn your head the way you can now.
Did you ever break up or tend to break
up? Oh, yes, people did it all the time. And the other thing that would happen, of course, was that the script would be dragging, in which case the control, you can't do it on radio, but they had special gestures in the control room to tell you to either speed up, they'd turn their fingers in a circle, and if you were wasting too much time, it was going too slowly, they'd take their finger across their neck and a cut sign. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, and this did not happen infrequently, right in the middle of a radio program, the director would be busily rewriting the script just one line ahead of yours, so that you had to be able to follow, scribble things, and suddenly have a whole half of a page cut out, but yet sound as if it were perfectly all right. It really was, it kept you on your mettle, that kind of thing.
Well, I guess it must have.
Yeah.
But
especially for kids, you know, it's yeah. Definitely adults mm-hmm. or something like that.
Actually, in many cases, the children were better at it than the adults. They weren't as flappable. It was really interesting that would happen.
But I suppose when you're working against a clock, and if a program does start to slow down, in other words, the actors are dragging just a little bit somewhere along the line, you're going to have
cut.
To meet that
right.
network cue, yeah. And so cuts would have to be made.
That was a little easier than having gone too fast and having time to use up. That was a worse problem, because you can always cut, but what are you going to do if you need to write something in a hurry? And then you just have to start speaking very slowly.
They would give you the stretch sign.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, we have a very long closing musical bridge.
Yeah,
about,
something like
about eight
that.
Choruses. Mm-hmm.
They didn't use recordings in those days, did they?
No, they really didn't have any to use except for music. They had extensive music libraries at that time, and I still do, of course, but that was about the only kind of thing they did record.
What about musical bridges and so on? Did they have organists in the studio?
Yes, almost always, mm-hmm, or pianists, one or the other. And it's really easier to work with a live player because they can speed up or slow down pretty much to order.
Did you ever get any fan mail?
We got the most fascinating fan mail, especially on the Sunday morning children's program. We would get gifts from people, homemade jellies and cakes and dolls, and we had some fans that wrote us for years, two or three times a year, and Christmas cards and birthday presents. It was really very touching. I mean, mm-hmm. A lot of these people were shut-ins or elderly people, and they depended so much on their radio for entertainment that they got the feeling that they really knew the people involved.
On the Coast to Coast on a Bus program, did Milton Cross interview each of you each week? Did people get to know you? How was that handled?
No, I guess they figured that if people listened to it regularly, they got to know the children, because it was pretty much the same group. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, I was down visiting my mother, and she has most of the old photographs and things from those days. And we had a cast party out in the country, and we all went in costume, and there was this crazy picture of all of us kids in all of our various costumes standing in the middle of a real barn,
mm-hmm.
because there was another show at that time that I think was on Saturdays that was generated out of Coast to Coast on a Bus called Our Barn, and there we all are. It was really sort of a shock to see it.
Of course, they did those publicity shots for the purpose, I suppose, of giving them away to as premiums or using them in
the
magazines. Oh, yeah.
People would be sent them if they wrote in and asked. At times, I think they must have been somewhat startled, because I don't think a lot of the children looked the way they thought they would.
Yeah, they never do. That's right.
Yeah.
That holds true, incidentally, for today.
Yes, I'm sure it does.
You should see the mental pictures they have of us.
Well, you know, when you listen to these children's shows, Dick, that they are done very well and very professionally and very seriously. You know, even though they're kids, they don't fool around and they do a job. What was the character like of the children? Were they all very strict, or how would you characterize a child actor or actress in that period?
I don't think I could, because there was such a variance. Some of them, like Florence Halep, who was Mae West on March of Time, was a real sort of obvious stage kid. Some of the others were not. A lot of them went on to do other things. I'm thinking of Let's Pretend, which was Nyla Mack's children's program on CBS on Saturday mornings, which I think was the best of the whole bunch. She did a first-rate job. And, you know, the people that started out on that program as children actors and actresses, 25 years later, were still playing those parts on her show, even though they were by then themselves grown up and had children of their own. It was real, and the voices hadn't changed a bit. Miriam Wolfe usually played the bad witch, and Estelle Levy, who was a very close friend of mine, played the good witches kinds mm-hmm. of things and funny parts. Jackie Grimes, who you mentioned before. Arthur Anderson usually played the prince, and Charita Bauer was often the princess. They just kept on going. I think listeners later on would have been really startled to get photographs of that cast.
We were talking about the March of Time. Suppose, Ed, we dip into your collection and listen to the March of Time right now.
Okay, Dick.
The editors of Time, the weekly news magazine, recreate from the pages of Time a year of world history. The March of Time. ...1941 was the year in which every continent on Earth lay on the scales of destiny. Which way would the scales tip by the time the Earth had rolled its 12-month course around the sun? As the year began, each people thought it knew. The leaders thought they knew. The leaders spoke. At year's beginning, Adolf Hitler spoke for the conquering Germans.
German people! The year 1941 will bring consummation of the greatest victory in our history.
At year's beginning, the foreign minister of Japan, Yosuke Matsuoka, spoke for the desperately ambitious Japanese.
I believe the white race must cede Oceania to the Asiatic.
The president of the United States spoke for the apprehensive Americans.
Lives of nations are determined not by the count of years, but by the lifetime of the human spirit. The life of a nation is the fullness of the measure of the will to live. There are men who doubt this. There are men who believe that democracy, as a form of government and a frame of life, is limited and measured by a kind of mystical and artificial fate. That for some unexplained reason, tyranny and slavery have become the surging wave of the future, and that freedom is an ebbing tide. But we Americans know that this is not true.
At year's beginning, Winston Churchill spoke for the brave and embattled Britain.
We shall not fail or falter. We shall not weaken or tire. Neither the sudden shock of battle, nor the long-drawn trials of vigilance and exertion will wear us down. Give us the tools, and we will finish the job.
If ever or ever a wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz is one because.
Give us the tools, the British asked. And America gave. Armed with them, the Empire troops marched into Axis-held Libya, singing a four-year-old American movie tune. We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
We hear he is the Wizard of Oz, if ever a wiz there was.
Until the more powerful Germans struck at Greece, and the British Army of the Western Desert had to turn and face new foes, the freedom-loving world took heart at its gallantry in Libya.
We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
The year that began 365 days ago was a year of conflict and great decisions, a year of triumph and defeats, a year of courage and a year of treachery. It was the year of British disaster on Crete and the curious battle for Syria, the year the British twice rolled the Axis back across Libya, the year Hitler was kept from getting his oil from Iran and Iraq. On the sea, it was the year of the Hood and the Bismarck, the year the Italian Navy got blasted out of its own ocean, and the year two men met on a battleship and wrote the Atlantic Charter. Thus, all year long, crisis was to follow crisis, and the news poured in 20,000 words an hour from every news front of the world. Day by day, the news was to become more personally important to Americans than ever before, more confusing, harder than ever to understand. And that is why more and more Americans are turning to Time, the weekly news magazine, to help them make the news make sense. For Time boils the news down for you and fits it together. Time queries and verifies the news. Time eliminates unconfirmed news and repetitious news. And thus Time untangles the events of the week and gives them to you as one clear, quick story of history in the making. In this way, the new issue of Time gives you in a single evening more real information than you could get from days of unorganized reading and listening. Gives you news from the home front, from the war front, from every important news front, from the march of time. The fateful year of 1941 was not to be seen by some who had done much to shape its happenings. One was Neville Chamberlain, who hoped to avoid war by appeasement, and who quietly died in England amid the ruins of peace in our time. One was the one-time imperial all-highest emperor of Germany, Kaiser Wilhelm II, to whom death, as it must to all men, came last spring at tulip time in Holland. One was an American, a clear-eyed observer, a brilliant author, who understood better than any of his ill-starred generation the cynically romantic mood of America following World War I. He was F. Scott Fitzgerald, the writer who gave his period its name, the Jazz Age. He had peopled his pages with flappers and philosophers and sad young men. He had caught the popular tunes of the 20s, to which so many of his contemporaries danced the hours away, sought to escape the crowding presence of reality. He and his generation sickened through the long depression and died together. A few days before the year began, his body lay in the back room of a Hollywood undertaker's chapel.
Has anyone come in to be with him or to say a prayer?
There have been a few callers, Mr. Scully, but no one has linked.
Poor Scott. To think nobody would stay with him his last 6 hours in this world.
May God let his kind soul rest in peace. I'll say a few prayers before we go. God help the poor souls in purgatory. May the souls of the faithful.
Scott Fitzgerald, at 44, had died at the end of an American era which none portrayed more sensitively than he. Significantly, he had said of his greatest character, Jay Gatsby,
"He believed in the green light, the orgiastic future that year by year recedes before us. It eluded us then, but that's no matter. Tomorrow we will run faster, stretch out our arms farther, and one fine morning, so we beat on, bolts against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past."
An excerpt from The March of Time with our guest, Gene Burnett. Well, Gene, you weren't in it, but that's the program that you were featured on many, many times. We'll get back to our guest right after this message from our sponsor.
1975 has been a year of growth for two hometown banking friends and neighbors who have now joined together to better serve you. During this year, the Cromwell Savings Bank has joined with Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank to offer even greater convenience to customers at any one of their six locations. An account at either bank is now an account at both. This means that these two hometown friends can now serve your best interest in every banking way. In addition to a number of savings plans designed to suit your individual needs, personal loans, home improvement loans, personal checking accounts will also be available starting January 1st. So stop in soon and apply for your personal checking account. The Cromwell Savings Bank Division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has two convenient locations, at the corner of Main and West Streets and the new Cromwell Plaza office near Kmart. Farmers and Mechanics has offices in Middletown at Main and College Streets and also on Washington Street. Other locations include Montville and Colchester, member FDIC and equal housing lenders. As 1976 approaches, they look forward to providing even better service to you and your family. Now, once again, back to Dick Bertel.
Gene Burnett is Public Relations Director for the Wadsworth Athenaeum here in Hartford. But Gene had a very remarkable, although short-lived, radio career as a child actress back in the 30s. And we're reminiscing about those years tonight. We're talking about some of the programs on which you appeared. But beyond the programs for just a moment, Gene, did you get involved at all with other aspects of this business, either on stage or what have you?
Yes, well, most of us did. For instance, modeling was something that a lot of us did. And when I was 11, I had the great honor of being photographed by Cecil Beaton for Vogue magazine. I was not the only person in the photograph. There were four of us models. I think there was a little girl younger than I and then two older girls in extremely flowery garden party dresses. It took 5 hours to take that one photograph because Cecil Beaton was a real perfectionist. I was coming down with a strep infection, which almost killed me, as a matter of fact. I felt so flaked out that day, I couldn't imagine what was happening. But between that and the lights, it was really grueling. And after he took the photograph and developed the one that he wanted, he then hand-tinted it, no less. And somewhere in my mother's storage cabinet, there is a copy of that page of Vogue magazine from, I think, somewhere in the late 1930s.
And they would reproduce it in color for the magazine.
Yes, yeah. Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm.
How about stage?
Well, we did a fair amount of that, too. For instance, I was in a short-lived production that starred Morris Evans, the actor. And I can't, for the life of me, remember the name of it. It didn't last too long.
Maybe that's why it didn't last too long.
And maybe that's it. It would have gone on the road, which could have been a problem for me, actually. I was not prepared to go on the road. We did a lot of other kinds of entertaining as children, too. A lot of charity entertaining for people in tubercular institutions, even mental institutions. That could be quite an experience for a child if you weren't prepared for it. And
did they prepare you for it?
Well, there's not a whole lot you can do to prepare somebody for that if you're 10 or 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a little difficult. I think one of the things that I remember with the least favor is auditions. Usually if we were casting a stage play, for instance, White Horse Inn, which had a great many children in it, they would send out just sort of a blanket call, and literally hundreds of children would arrive, with mothers, of course, and then would begin that laborious, grueling process of everybody in their turn coming out on the stage and doing whatever it was they came prepared to do. And 9 times out of 10, they wouldn't get more than 2 minutes of it in, and the director would say, "All right, that's enough. We'll let you know." It's really an awful experience.
Yeah.
I did not care for that.
Well, you had a reputation that helped you in a lot of cases where you didn't have to audition, I would imagine, for many of the things you did.
Well, there were very few things that you didn't have to audition for, even people with reputations.
Really?
Yes, they were always looking for new talent and new faces and new kinds of things to do. So unless you were an absolutely top-flight star, you almost always had to audition.
Mm. Did you ever do Columbia Workshop? There was a great show with a great prestige factor.
Yes, and it was a well-deserved prestige because I have never been on any radio show that was done with the kind of precision that that was. The one that stands out in my mind was the one that Carlton Young starred in. He was a well-known radio actor for years. It was about, I think we talked earlier about it being the Owl Creek Bridge incident.
Yeah, I think it's possible. It could be the same show, yes. Yeah.
In any case, it started out with a man drowning, and then the entire show was flashbacks of his life. Well, poor Carlton Young had to run between the microphone where most of the action was taking place to a specially constructed little area that was surrounded by curtains, and in that area he breathed. Those were the sequences where they would flash back to him drowning, and it was really a very difficult thing for him to do. He had to breathe deeply and in a measured fashion in between running back to the other microphone and using his ordinary voice. It was a half-hour show, and that particular one took 2 solid days of rehearsing to get straight.
Now,
so
there wasn't any studio audience for a program.
Oh, like no, this. Not for that sort of thing.
Yeah. You know, I remember, Ed, maybe you recall, Inner Sanctum did a story along the same lines of a man drowning. And they capitalized on the fact that you go down three times, you know, and there they had their three acts. That was the way.
That's essentially the way that one was,
then
too.
It was probably based on the same story, mm-hmm. yeah. And then suddenly, as he was recollecting his past, he would splash up to the to the surface again and breathe. And that's probably... That's probably what we're referring to with the breathing. Gasping for air as he's going down.
It was very hard for him to do. He really had a heck of a time with it.
Yeah. Why did you decide to get out of show business?
Yeah, that's such a great start.
Well, primarily because I wanted to go on to school and to college, and it really was pretty hard to do both. Very few people did. And so I just gradually phased out of it, although I stayed in professional children's school until I graduated. And then went on to Barnard College from there. There was a long hiatus between that part of my life and coming to the Athenaeum, which is back in show business again, essentially. Many ways it is. Every time we put on any kind of an exhibition or anything, it's very much like the curtain going up on a play the night mm-hmm. that the thing opens, because we're all running around like mad people to the last minute, then all dash home and come back in our elegant clothes and look as if we haven't been doing anything all day long.
You know, you should think in terms of maybe... asking someone to do a radio exhibit sometime, you know, some way, somehow, that should be a part of art, I would think.
Well, it certainly has its place. I think that those early days in radio especially have a kind of charm that's disappeared.
Yeah, I'm afraid you're right. Let's go back to the, as you pointed out, Gene, the best children's program of them all.
The classic show, that would be Let's Pretend.
Yes.
And I guess it was wonderful to be a part of that because every good actress, you know, young actress or actor did appear, I guess. That was really the epitome or the top of the pyramid.
It's kind
it?
Of a training ground, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, we have one very familiar story, Dick. You may have heard of it. It's called Cinderella. Is that ring a bell at all?
Yeah.
And this is how it was done in those days.
Story of Cinderella, written and directed by Nyla Mack for Let's Pretend. Hello there, pretenders.
Hello, Uncle Bill.
How do we travel to Magic Land?
It's a B-29, Uncle Bill. Everybody ready?
Yes, let's go.
One, two, three.
All right, let's go. Once upon a time, a cruel woman married a man she didn't love. Then, demanding that he journey far away to increase their wealth, she took her own two heartless daughters and arrived at her new husband's home, where, until then, only love and gentle consideration had been known.
Now, girls, before we go in, here's what we'll do. The first thing is to put this daughter of his in her place.
You're right, Mother.
And the sooner, the better.
She'll soon find out who's in command here. Are you ready?
Yes, mm-hmm. Let's go in.
Remember, don't waver an inch.
Oh, how do you do? You're my new mother and my two new sisters, aren't you? Do come in.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm so very happy to welcome you here. May I call you Mother?
Indeed you may not. How ridiculous.
Oh. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say anything that would offend you. I only wanted to welcome you to our house.
Your house? Please remember, girl, that from now on, this isn't your house, but ours.
Of course. Well, whatever we have is yours, too, from now on. Are you Flora or Isabella?
I'm Flora, but Miss Flora to you, my girl. Please remember your place.
I shall be so glad to have two sisters. And you're Isabella, aren't you?
I'm Miss Isabella, but don't call me sister. You may help me to dress and wash my clothes if you like. But don't think that we can ever take you into our family, you poor little ugly thing.
And if she expects to live here, she might as well know she'll have to work for her keep.
I don't understand.
I'm sure she'll never be anything else but a scullery maid, Mother. She's too ugly and clumsy.
Yes, if she doesn't break all the dishes first, I dare say she'll learn to be useful.
Why are you sitting over there on the hearth, simpleton? You'll scatter the cinders all about the room. Look
get-a girls. Trying to hide in them, were you? I know your name from now on. It's Cinderella.
Cinderella! Never around when you want her. Cinderella! Cinderella!
Did you call me?
Certainly. You were told to help us dress for the ball.
I was working in the kitchen.
Stupid, don't stand there. Start to curl my hair.
Call mine first.
And I want it done beautifully, too. The prince is to dance with me tonight.
Yes, you'd better do hers first. My hair is easy to dress because it's naturally lovely.
Your hair is lovely. Ha! Then so is a horse's tail.
Oh, stepmother, mayn't I go to the ball tonight? Oh, I'd love to see the prince and dance and hear the music. May I, madam, please?
You go to the ball? You, a scullery maid?
Can you imagine how the prince would laugh at your awkwardness? I can hear him now.
Please, don't make fun of me anymore. Can't you love me just a little? I'd do all I know to please you. Won't you be kind to me?
Oh, stop talking and fasten Isabella's dress.
Ouch! Don't pinch me like that. And don't spill your tears on my gown, either.
It's time we were going. Hurry up, you've made us late now.
I'm sorry, Miss Flora.
Oh, hurry up.
Oh, here comes the coach. Hurry, girls, are you ready?
Oh, yes, Mother.
Oh, what lovely horses. Oh, please, stepmother, let me go, if only to watch from a corner.
Certainly not. Come, girls. Isabella, get your fan.
I have, Mother.
Pick up your train, Flora.
Yes,
come on.
Ma'am.
You may stand in the doorway and watch us drive off.
Hurry, driver, we're late now.
Why should they be so unkind to me? I've tried every way I know to please them. Oh, how lonely and miserable I am. I wish I had someone to talk to. Someone who would understand.
Don't cry, Cinderella. You'll spoil your pretty face.
What a lovely lady you are. But who are you?
I'm your fairy godmother, Cinderella. One who loves and understands. And I'm going to send you to the ball.
My fairy godmother? Oh, how wonderful. But how can you do it? I have no clothes. I have no carriage. How can I go?
Oh, a fairy godmother can do anything. Listen carefully and do as I say. Fetch me that pumpkin by the pantry door.
Pumpkin by the pantry door. Here it is.
Put it there in the roadway. Now, do you see this magic wand I have in my hand?
Is it magic?
Of course it is. Watch. I touch the pumpkin so. And there's your golden coach.
A golden coach? Oh, fairy godmother, how perfectly wonderful. Now what do we do?
Why, the horses are next, aren't they?
Oh, dear, yes, and we have none.
Get the mousetrap in the cupboard.
The mousetrap in the cupboard. Here it is, godmother. Oh, it has 6 little mice in it.
Now, open the door of the trap and let the mice out one at a time and watch the magic wand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There are your 6 dancing white horses.
What beautiful horses. Oh, they're the prettiest I ever saw. They're shod with gold. Oh, how thrilling. Now, what do we do?
Why, we must have a coachman, mustn't we?
Oh, goodness, where will we find one?
Fetch me that rat trap by the cellar steps. Is there a rat in it?
Oh, yes, look, a great big fat one.
Oh, splendid. What a jolly driver he'll make. Open the door. Watch.
Oh, well, good evening. Bless you, pretty princess. Thought I'd never get here. Where to, my lady?
Fairy godmother. Now he's a coachman in purple livery. Isn't he fun?
Oh, I'm a jolly one, I am. And the best driver in the country.
Boy and eggs. Whoa!
Am I ready to go?
Indeed not. A fine princess must have footmen. Cinderella, bring me 6 lizards.
6 lizards, godmother? Wherever will I find them?
Oh, you don't know the way of fairies, do you? Look, they are by the dooryard.
Oh, I see them. 6 huge lizards. I'll get them. Here they are.
Then here we go. Your footman, princess.
Where to, your highness?
Oh, look. 6 handsome footmen in gold uniforms, too. Oh, fairy godmother.
Whoa! These horses are getting restless waiting, princess.
Now I think we're almost ready.
But fairy godmother, look at my dress. It's nothing but rags. How can I go to the ball?
Stand still, Cinderella. Close your eyes.
Now open them. What do you see?
A dress. A creamy white velvet, trimmed with ermine.
And your hair?
Silver and crystal roses are twined in my braids. How beautiful.
You look like a lovely silver moonbeam, my darling.
Cinderella from Let's Pretend.
Nyla Mack, by the way, who directed that show, was really a marvelous person. I liked her very much. She was awfully good with the kids. Madge Tucker, who is now dead, I can say that she was a tough babe to work with. She was the one that I worked with most at National Broadcasting.
We'll get back to our guest, Jean Burnett, right after this message.
This evening, the folks at the Cromwell Savings Bank Division and Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank would like to dispense with their usual commercial message schedule for this time in order to extend season's greetings to you, one and all. It's their hope that your family has been joined together in spirit as well as actual physical presence during this season of the year when family unity is so important to us all. It's also their hope that the spirit of unity and brotherhood, so apparent now, will carry over into the new year. And so, with little more than 2 days remaining in 1975, Mr. Ralph H. Morgan, President, and Mr. Arthur E. Webster, Jr., Executive Vice President, and the entire staff of the Cromwell Savings Bank Division and Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank wish you and your family a prosperous and peaceful 1976, our nation's bicentennial year. They promise to continue their efforts in providing you with friendly, efficient, hometown banking service. Now back to Dick Bertel.
Jean Burnett is with us tonight. We're reminiscing about the early days of radio as a child actress. Is there any one particular incident before we say goodnight, Jean, that comes to mind that was either harrowing or funny or memorable in some way for you?
Well, I've been trying to think of some particular incident, and I'm going to go completely off the map with this because what I'm thinking about is the graduation ceremonies at professional children's school, which were unique. Instead of having the ordinary kinds of graduation ceremonies, we put on a play. And the year that I graduated from grammar school there, Peter Donald, who you remember from radio,
sure,
was graduating from high school, and he wrote and produced a play called Snow White and the Seven Drama Critics. It was the year that the New York theater was in a state of collapse. And Snow White was the theater, the seven dwarfs were the seven drama critics, and to Cinderella, to Snow White's aid came the WPA Theater, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, and several things like that. And Walter Houston gave us our diplomas that year. So that was the kind of graduation ceremonies professional children had.
I'm sure that would be memorable. Jean Burnett, thank you so much for being with us tonight and sharing these memories with our Golden Age of Radio audience. And until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
And his music.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Cromwell Savings Division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. Hometown friends, serving your best banking interests in every way. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bob Sherrago and Dick Bertel.
Benny Goodman Swing School, the Tuesday evening rally of everybody everywhere who gets a lift from the new pulsating music of youth, swing.
The Lux Radio Theater brings you Rita Hayworth and Charles Corbin in...